Blog Talk Radio.
Ceremonic ceremonial magic. And I'm your host, Pope Runyon, and we're on the air, and this is the Hermetic Hour. For the next hour, we will be talking about Hermetic science, Solomonic ceremonial magic, as is taught by the Church of the Hermetic Sciences and the Order of the Temple of Astarte, the OTA. And I might mention that the Order of the Temple of Astarte is probably the oldest continually practicing ceremonial magic lodge in the United States. We got started back in 1969-1970, and we incorporated under the Church of the Hermetic Sciences in 1971. We've been continually teaching and practicing ceremonial magic in the Solomonic Hermetic tradition ever since. Now tonight, what we're going to do is we're going to outline Hermetic philosophy and its history, and we'll draw a distinction between Hermetic magic and witchcraft and Satanism. And then we're going to discuss the aspects of astrology and Kabbalah and alchemy that bear upon Hermetic magic, and we'll discuss the principles of the invocation, that's the calling down of the angels, and evocation, calling up the spirits. And we'll describe the inner workings of the magical visionary process, and we'll explain the hypnotic and subjective nature of this phenomenon while we maintain the inner spiritual reality of the human imagination. Now, that's what we're going to cover, and so let's get right into it by talking about the history of the Hermetic tradition. Way back, actually, or before the time of Christ, in Alexandria in Egypt, this was the center of the intellectual world at that time. And the Greeks, of course, were in control of Alexandria in Egypt. But what they had accomplished was a fusion of the Egyptian, ancient Egyptian mystery traditions and the Greek and the Gnostic traditions, and it all came together in this very cosmopolitan, very sophisticated environment in Alexandria, where they had the wonderful Library of Alexandria, and they had literally a university which taught such subjects as astrology and the beginnings of Kabbalah, because Kabbalah was just getting started around that time. And they taught alchemy and hermetic magic. And this is where it all got started, was in Alexandria. And it was essentially based on a philosophy that was referred to as Hermetic, after Hermes Trismegistus, thrice greatest Hermes, who was a Greco-Egyptian version of the original Egyptian god Thoth. And the original Egyptian god Thoth, of course, was the god of wisdom and the god of writing and knowledge. Now, Hermes Trismegistus, whoever he really was, we're not sure, but the writings that have come down to us, called the Corpus Hermeticum, or the Hermetic treatises, the Pomander, the Asclepius, and various other Hermetic treatises, like the Emerald Tablet of Hermes, and these various Hermetic writings, they were philosophically absolutely transcendental, beyond anything that that had come up before, and yet they were, and we now know they were based on ancient Egyptian principles. The idea behind the Hermetic philosophical principle was that man was a miniature of the universe itself, that man was the agent of God on earth, that the individual human being was actually the eyes and the ears of God, and that he, the individual human being, had a connection to God, and that if he knew this, if he was initiated into this divine knowledge, that he could share in the creative power of God. This was a concept that later, and now this is the latest take on this. Later, this concept, of course, appears in Christianity and in some of the teachings of Jesus. It was thought for many years that Hermetic science followed the teachings of Jesus, but no, actually now we're beginning to realize that these teachings preceded the teachings of Jesus in this regard, although that in no way diminishes the teachings of Jesus, which are very profound. However, it is a similar idea that the kingdom of God is within you, and you are the special agent of God. And if you realize this, if you realize the significance of the fact that you have a special divine relationship with the great Almighty God and all of his agents and angels and gods and even controlling the demons and whatever, that if you have this realization, and if you fully understand this realization, that you have the ability to share in God's creative power. This is what's behind the philosophy of Hermetic magic. And this is why during the Renaissance in the Middle Ages and in the Renaissance, Hermetic philosophy became the basis of the magical tradition. Now, one of the things that we should mention here was that these Hermetic treatises were translated in the Renaissance. They were first translated by Marsilio Ficino, an Italian scholar, under the patronage of the Medicis, and they were considered more important even than Plato. And the Medicis wanted these Hermetic treatises to be translated first because they knew how vitally important they were at that time. So for about 100 years, the Italian scholars, the philosophers of the Renaissance, were completely in tune with this Hermetic principle. They considered it the top philosophical principle. However, what happened in 1614, a philologist, a language expert by the name of Isaac Casaubon, proved that the particular version of the Hermetic treatises that Ficino had translated were in fact written down in after Jesus, after at least 200 years after the death of Christ. And this meant that they weren't pre-Christian, they were actually post-Christian, according to Casaubon's analysis. And the result of that was that the church turned against the Hermetic tradition, and you couldn't get an imprimatur on a Hermetic book, no matter how what kind of a scholar you were, the church wouldn't permit it. And so the statues of Hermes that they had in the churches in Italy, they were just about to canonize him, make a saint out of him. They took them out and broke them up and threw them into the gutter, and Hermes became, for all the way up to just a few years ago, Hermes Trismegistus was considered to be post-Christian. It's considered to be sort of a pagan, me-too Christianity kind of thing. Well, that's all changed now. We realize that these Hermetic treatises were quite probably earlier than the birth of Christ. And so we're back to the academic community anyway, having a tremendous respect for something that in the Middle Ages we all in the Renaissance, the magicians based their whole philosophy upon. Now, so consequently, from Hermetic science and from Hermetic philosophy arose the alchemical tradition, the magical tradition, and we might say that they dovetailed and interwove and interpenetrated with the astrological tradition. The astrology probably came really before Hermetic revelations. It probably came. Astrology probably began way back. At least a primitive form of it began back in the Neolithic, when people looked up at the stars and began to wonder what was going on up there and started to keep records. And we even have a lunar calendar from way back about 30,000 years ago. So astrology probably came along first. And this is where, you might say almost the Hermetic philosophy is an outgrowth of man's pondering the stars and pondering the heavens back when civilization was just on the horizon. Civilization, by the way, as far as we know, we can prove right now, is 11,500 years ago was when the first temples and the first cities were first built. So it's a lot older than we used to think. But astrology is probably where this all got started, because the idea that that man is a miniature of the universe itself. Now, this dovetails perfectly with Hermetic philosophy, because if as we believe in Hermetic philosophy, that we are miniatures of the greater universe, this means that the planets and the stars, the planets, the zodiac, the moon, all have a direct connection with us. And in Hermetic philosophy, we believe that we have this whole solar system and our little universe inside ourselves, and so we tune ourselves up with the greater universe. This is one of the things that makes magic work in a transpersonal sense. In other words, magic works on yourself. Primarily, it's self-transformative, but it also has an effect on the outside world. And I know that people think that, it's just all psychological. Well, no, it's not. It's not at all. And in fact, the human imagination, hooked up with the magical correspondences, is a tremendous, powerful, powerful engine. Now, one of the things about this that we should point out is that even though Hermetic magic is essentially a pagan development, in other words, it came along before Christianity and it flourished after Christianity, it was incorporated into, however, the Judeo-Christian tradition, and the great Hermetic magicians of the Renaissance were Judeo-Christians. And they didn't find any problem with relating this to their religious system, and they put the angels, and even had a place for Jesus, although he might have been a bit completely comfortable there. But the Rosicrucians, actually, they were Hermetic magicians, and they were they realized how important Jesus's philosophy and revelations were. So there was no. There was nothing to do here with Satanism, and there's nothing to do with witchcraft in the sense that this was not anti-Christian. It was not anti-Jewish. It was not this in a philosophical and a higher sense. This was incorporated with it. And in many respects, these Hermetic magicians were actually, they were clerics. One of the men who was most responsible for codifying medieval magic during the early Renaissance period was an abbot, a young abbot of a monastery named Trithemius. And Trithemius was, of course, the mentor of Cornelius Agrippa, whom most all of us in the Hermetic science have heard of course. Now, one of the things that we need to discuss here at this point is the relationship between Kabbalah and alchemy and with Hermetic science. Now, alchemy is directly connected with Hermetic or early Hermetic science, Greco-Egyptian Hermetic science. In fact, alchemy has been referred to as the art of Chem. Alchemy, Chem was the ancient name for Egypt. And alchemy, I used to think when I first got started in the Hermetic tradition, I had a kind of a kind of an attitude toward alchemy like that was a psychological process. And I have since learned that alchemy is really, really the spagyric art of alchemy really does affect matter and really does affect substances and conditions outside of the psychological condition of the operator. And what the reason for this is that the alchemist uses his own desire and his own willpower and his own faith in his own power to create the effect on outside matter, and to create medicines and to create to transmute metals, to do these various what seem like miraculous operations, and actually they do work. And the reason for this, and we're beginning to find out now, is that the observer really does affect the experiment in regular physics. In regular chemistry, yes, the observer will. But the difference between alchemy and chemistry, in a technical sense, is that the chemist performs an operation in such a mechanical way that if he writes it all down and does it without any particular emotional involvement in it or any particular psychological involvement in it, he wants to say, okay, we bring this to such and such a temperature, and we do this, we add this, so much of this, so much of that, and we do this, and this, that, the other thing, and this is a replicatable experiment. And with scientific rigor, it's a replicatable experiment. Now, that's the way a chemist does it. The alchemist, on the other hand, he goes through the slow cooking process, and he is like a gourmet cook. He simmers, and as he simmers, and of course the molecules naturally are agitated as he slowly simmers this thing. And then his simmering, his patience, and his desire, that is what generates the change, what generates the transformation. Well, now that's not replicatable. You can't just say, oh, okay, at this point, desire what you want and you get it. Because this means that the operator himself, his psyche, his desire, his magical power, if you will, or alchemical expertise, if you will, is going to affect the act. And that's the real difference between alchemy and science. Now, one of the things that has actually hurt Hermetic science and tended to discredit it was the whole Cartesian process of that occurred in the late Renaissance, where we began in the age of so-called reason and the age of enlightenment, where we began to to get away from what we call superstition, and where we had replicatable experiments for everything. Everything had to be written down. It had to be just done expertly. And if you couldn't weigh it, you couldn't weigh it and measure it. If you couldn't define it, if you couldn't completely analyze it, then it wasn't important and it didn't exist. And the human imagination was downgraded. And this, of course, was a sad thing, because the human imagination is the greatest power we have. And especially if you're a believer in Hermetic science, you know that the human imagination, everything starts with the human imagination. What was it in that the Conan movie that Arnold was in, you know, where they had the riddle of steel? And he says, well, which is stronger, flesh or steel? Flesh is stronger, because flesh is much stronger. Steel is inert. It's the flesh that wields it. And this is the truth about the imagination. Everything that we have created was first imagined in our imagination. Now, this is one of the big secrets behind the Kabbalah and behind the Hermetic philosophy, is the idea of magical preforms. And the idea that if you have in your imagination first the form of something, the idea of something, that, and if you really desire it and you imagine it strongly enough and clearly enough, it will come about. And that's the first stage of it, and that's the most dynamic stage of it. And after it's completed, and after it's built, and after it, then it's starting to decay. It's static at that point. So really, the imagination, the original vision of a thing, has more dynamism and more power than the finished product itself. I think that we lose sight of the power of the imagination, and with all of our engineering dictum about science, we feel that we downgrade the imagination. We don't realize this. Now, some years back, a scientist himself wrote a book called The Truth About Scientific Revelations by Kahn. I think it's like the fellow by the name of Kahn. Anyway, he pointed out in this book that almost 90% of the great breakthroughs in science, of the actual breakthroughs, were not a result of direct research. They were a result of an inspiration. The scientist struggled and struggled and struggled and struggled and did all these experiments. Then he went to bed and woke up the next morning and he suddenly realized how to do it. That inspiration is really the key to scientific advancement. And so one of the things we would like to do with magic is we would like to perfect and to fine-tune and perfect and make a creative process, a magical creative process, out of training our imagination and out of searching into the deep mind to bring up visions that are even beyond ourselves, that are way beyond ourselves. One of the things I think that we should remember in that regard is that, I think it was Socrates, wasn't it Socrates, who said that we don't learn anything, we just remember things. Well, the implications of that, of course, are awesome. Now, let's for a moment mention one of our modern Hermetic philosophers, Carl Jung. Now, Carl Jung came up with a concept which is very important in modern magic. His concept of the collective unconscious. And this idea of Carl Jung's is perfectly fits in with the Hermetic philosophy, because Carl Jung had this idea that if you go down into the unconscious deep enough, you get into what is called the collective unconscious of the human race. And this collective unconscious is where the archetypes, where the ancient pagan gods, where the savior architect, the savior archetype, and the archetype of the trickster, and all these various mythological figures, where they reside, and they're universal, and we can access them. And if we think about Hermetic philosophy, says that each one of us is the eyes and the ears of God. Each one of us has this link to God. This means that each one of us is connected to God. So there is this concept of the universal mind, and which fits perfectly well into what Jung is talking about with the collective unconscious. Now, we can tap into that. So when we say that we're going to evoke a spirit, or we're going to invoke an angel, now I can say, well, yeah, we'll do this, and we'll do it in a crystal ball, we'll do it in a dark mirror, we'll do this, but I don't expect that if you see this spirit in the mirror, in the dark mirror, I don't expect that somebody can photograph it. I don't expect that you're going to see it the same way I see it. We know it's subjective, and yet at the same time, we are accessing this universal mind. We're beyond ourselves. We're down into the collective unconscious of the race itself, and we're on a different level, even though we are using our own minds, and we're not extra personalizing this thing where it can jump out and bite us or anything like that. No. No, this is unfortunate that we've gotten around to, and this is a Western thing primarily, that we've gotten around to the point where we think that unless we can actually photograph the spirit, unless the spirit appears the same and speaks the same to everybody in the circle or whatever, that it's not really real, it's not really happening or whatever. This is not the way magic works, and magic never has worked this way. And I can tell you right now that when we talk in magic about spirits, we use the term disembodied spirits. We mean exactly that. These spirits are not physical entities that you can photograph. They're not supposed to be. But yet, they have a very definite transpersonal reality. They are bigger than you are, and they extend a lot further than you do. Because if you are the eyes and ears of God, then you have access, ultimately, you have access to the whole universe. There's no boundaries to the human imagination. If the human imagination is connected to the universal mind, which it is. So, the way we evoke a spirit, and when I say evocation, I mean bring a spirit up out of our collective unconscious through our subconscious. The way we do it is we use a dark reflective mirror. We put this mirror in the center of a triangle. That we use a triangle because this is a Kabbalistic device whereby we have created a triangular plane. And that triangular plane contains the spirit in the mirror because, quite frankly, there's a Pythagorean geometry at work here. I may as well explain that the Hebrew Kabbalah owes a lot to Pythagoras, and it owes something to Hermes that owes a lot to Pythagoras, and yet it's a biblical structure. We use that because the biblical structure helps us use those archetypes from the Bible, which are already implanted in our subconscious and our collective unconscious. So the triangle is point. One point, second point, That's a line. Third point forms a plane. And then that mirror becomes the fourth point, and that's the first solid, and it holds it right in the mirror. And we put that right outside the circle. So we got our face. We use our own face in the mirror. Now, we use our own face in the mirror, and as we stare at our reflection, with the sigil, of course, of the spirit, or the signature of the spirit in grease pencil across, which tends to break up the structure and also tends to personify the spirit itself, because it is the spirit signature. And then you have your face in the mirror, and you stare at it, and then there's an optical phenomenon where your face will black out, go dark, and then it will come back, and then it'll be something different. And it will be a distortion that is first time you experience this. It's quite an experience, I can tell you. And then you will be, if you are properly trained, you can actually let the spirit speak through your voice. And now you ask, you say, well, this is my reflection. I can't be a spirit. Oh yeah, but remember, you are the representative of God. You are in touch with the universal mind. You have everything. The whole universe is within your reach. So consequently, your reflection, and remember the biblical passage that God created man in his own image, well, that's where it is, right there. So the spirit is an aspect that extends from your image, but on the other hand, that spirit is very, very much an entity that exists in millions of other subconscious realms, and so it has a very much of a transpersonal reality of its own. And don't ever think it doesn't. Just because you can't photograph it, and just because somebody else sees it differently, that doesn't mean that it doesn't have a universal existence, a very powerful universal existence. Now with angels. Angels are creatures of light, and they are creatures of light and balance, and they are positive, for the most part, positive aspects and creative aspects of what we call God, the love principle. I might want to mention at this point that one of the founders, or the original inspirers and founders of Hermetic philosophy, Empedocles, divided the entire universe was divided into air, earth, fire, water, love, and strife. That's everything. The whole business. Air, earth, fire, water, love, and strife. Well, now the angels represent the love principle, and the spirits sometimes represent the strife principle. But there's no good and evil involved in this. I mean, love and strife, you can't have all love, because if you had all love, everything would just coalesce and become one great big blob and wouldn't go anywhere. And if you have all strife, then we're all in continual misery. So, consequently, we have to have a balance between the two. Now, the angels represent the love principle, the spirits represent the strife principle, if you want to look at it that way. And so, when we want to bring in the angels, we use a crystal. We use a crystal ball. Now, this isn't something we just developed in modern times. The methods that I'm talking about here were used back in the Renaissance. They were used by most of the magicians in the Renaissance that we know of actually used crystals and to a lesser extent, dark mirrors. And what they would do is they would stare at the crystal and in a dim light with the candles focused around it, they'd stare at the crystal. And they would repeat the invocation over and over and over again. They keep repeating it, and then there would be a glow that would appear around the crystal, an aura that would come over the ball, and then they would have the angel call down. His presence would be in that crystal, and at that point they could be in contact with the angel. Now, whereas with the spirits in the mirror, you actually see their faces, and you know, some people think that they appear in terrible form. Actually, The grimoire we use says over and over again, appear in fair and human form without horror or deformity and without delay. So the angel, but the angels in the crystal do not have to show you a face or even a body because they're creatures of light. So you have this tremendous feeling of presence and this glow in the crystal, and you know that the angel is there, and the angel speaks through you and can take over your voice. As I will sit around the altar and I'll say, Frater Johannes, invoke. And he'll invoke, and then I'll go around and I'll say, Frater Buto, invoke. And we'll keep going and going around, and then when we get the angel, I will say, Frater Johannes, does the angel speak through you? And there's Johannes over there looking up at the crystal, and he says, yes, I am with you all, and you are all under my protection. And he'll channel. You know, you think this channeling process is so mysterious, and only these New Age gurus can do it. No, we channel every week. some of it is very enlightening and even profound. Now, this is the way that we do spirits, and this is the way we do angels. But you know, I want to point out that the process here that we're using, the process that we're using here, is hypnotic, and for many, many years, different magical groups like the Golden Dawn and the OTO would not permit their members to use hypnosis in any form. And yet magic, as you could probably tell from what I've been talking about, magic's a hypnotic process. It's an auto-hypnotic and a group-hypnotic process, very definitely. It has to be. And yet, the reason why these old Victorian magical groups didn't use the hypnotic process and kind of crippled themselves in this sense was because hypnosis had a bad reputation. Now, these mesmerists were all the vogue in those days, and they'd get out on stage and wave their hands at somebody and put them into a trance and pick them up and get three men to walk on them, form a bridge out of the poor person, and get up there and sit on them, and all kinds of stuff that they did, and they were really amazing performers. But this gave hypnosis a very, very bad reputation. We had a novel about called Trilby, in which their character Svengali, which has since become a household word. And Svengali controlled poor Trilby with his hypnotic power, and so consequently, they were against hypnosis, and they even had their members taking an oath against hypnosis. Well, that's a darn shame, because hypnosis is the technique which makes visionary magic actually work. So, what you should do, if you're going to learn this, you have to learn self-hypnosis. You have to be able to hypnotize yourself. And you talk to yourself out loud, and you talk to your subconscious, and this enables you, this gives you the loop that you need to be able to actually vocalize the spirits. And then the other thing that you need to be able to do, and that we teach, is various disciplines of yoga. And one of the yogas that you really, really need to work on is what we call Pranakam yoga. And this is the yoga of the fixed gaze. You will train yourself to stare at a fixed point. You can use a little blue flower like the Tibetans do, or a little pearl on a piece of black velvet, or whatever, a little point, and you stare at this without letting it entertain you with any kind of optical phenomenon or anything of that nature. You just stare at it, and with a fixed point of concentration, until you get to the point where your mind is empty, where your, well, we might better say your mind is calm. Actually, I don't like this empty mind. That's an Eastern thing. We calm, completely calm your mind and stare at this one point. And then teach yourself to become receptive, alert, but your mind is completely calm, and this way you will learn to be able to receive with the conjuration devices that we use, the dark mirror and the crystal ball. So, Kratakam yoga is very important. Also, we have in the OTA, we have developed over the years a system of tantric yoga which relates to and is completely compatible with the Kabbalah. And what we have is a line of psychic centers or chakras that are a development of the middle pillar exercise for those of you that are familiar with it, but it's the whole set of chakras. And this whole set of chakras enables you to access from within yourself and in your own psyche, access and open and have a relationship, a deep relationship with the spheres of the Tree of Life. And this way we have gained, I believe, because I spent at least a year and a half with intensive study with the Sakya Tibetan order, and I learned how they do these magical techniques of theirs, and their techniques depend upon the use of internal psychic centers. This is the power of the East that we haven't had in Hermetic magic, because up until recently people couldn't figure out how to get the Kabbalah to dovetail with the Hindu psychic centers. Actually, the Tibetan psychic centers are different than the Hindu, and in fact, each Tibetan deity has a different set of chakras. And so, actually, coming up with a Kabbalistic chakra system was not as difficult as it might have been, except that, unfortunately, we here in the West believed that there was only one Eastern system, and our Kabbalah just didn't match up with it, so we didn't do anything with it. And, of course, I should admit that actually Paul Case had a system where he was more concerned with the paths of the Tree of Life than he was the spheres. And it places the planets in an order that does not follow the sequence of the Tree of Life. So it's difficult to use it in ceremonial work, and it's a good meditational system, I suppose, from an alchemical point. But actually, what we have in the OTA is the straight line right down the lightning flash all the way down. We can bring power down from Tipperath. We bring the power straight on down and then bring it straight back up. And it's a very dynamic system, and you can do it in just a few minutes, and you can have yourself tremendously empowered, and it's one of the most powerful things and techniques we have. And actually, to get right down to it, you want to ask, probably, and you'd be asking, what is the purpose of all of this? Why are we doing all of this? What do we get out of it? Well, the answer to that is that what we get out of it is to make ourselves more than human, in a sense that the magician strives to become more and more and more godlike. He strives to become more and more of the creator, more and more the master of the symbolic universe. And in this way, he brings himself or herself closer and closer to God. Now, Do we do this so we can control other people and so we can make money and so we can have power? No, not really. If that's what you want to go into magic for, well, you probably ought to go into something else, really. You might be better off in witchcraft or somewhere else on that. Magic, even though it is a tremendous power trip, if you want to use that term, but it's a power trip for your own development. It's a power trip to get you closer to God. It extends your consciousness out to reach the whole universe. Now, for instance, we believe that we are a miniature of the universe, and if you want to think of yourself, let me give a little example of how to grasp this whole thing. If we take Hermetic philosophy and try to get our arms around it, we realize that if you are the eyes and ears of God, then this means that you're directly connected to the central mind of God, so to speak. Now, realize how vast this is. There's millions, not just millions of stars, there are millions of galaxies. This universe is so big that it's almost impossible to imagine how big it is. But it's all a part of God. God has these consciousness points like ourselves, with eyes and ears, all over the universe. And a lot of these consciousness points are obviously a lot smarter than we are. They're a lot more advanced. They're vast. They're godlike beyond us. And then, of course, maybe below us, there might be some consciousness points we don't know about, like maybe the dolphins are consciousness points. I don't know. I used to train dolphins for a short time, and I really don't think they are. But we're pretty low on the consciousness point of God's scale, obviously, from the vastness of the universe. And yet we are. We are consciousness points of God. Each one of us is. Which means that each one of us, if we realize this, we are directly connected to God. Now, if you carry this a little further, you realize that you're at the center of the universe. Even though your eyes and ears are out on a stalk, you're still at the consciousness point is God. You're at the center of the universe right there. So once you realize this and that you grok it, so to speak, I mean, then at this point you say, well, I'd like to experience controlling this whole universe. And so the best way to do that is to build it inside you, is to build up this little universe inside you and use that to expand your consciousness so you can get the effect of being one with God. This has got to create, on the one hand, a huge ego, and on the other hand, it's got to, if you really think about it, you're going to have vast humility because you realize just how tiny you are and how small this planet is, and how are this little galaxy all the way off, way over in the corner of the rest of the universe. And so we have to be humble. And we also have to realize that while we're humble, we're still, in our tiny little way, we're still part of God. We're still right there, we're right there as one of God's intelligent sensors. And this is one of the things in Hermetic philosophy that Hermes teaches. He says that our purpose here on earth is to be the witness, is to witness God's creation. This is our purpose. We're here. We're his eyes and ears. Now, Jacob Boehm, the Christian mystic in the Renaissance in Germany, he understood this very, very well, and he based his philosophy on the Hermetic treatises. And this idea that we are the eyes and the ears of God, and that God is within us. Once you grasp this, you also realize another very, very important thing. You realize that you are immortal because you yourself are the consciousness. Nobody else is. You're the consciousness. And you know that those other people are consciousnesses too. You're aware of that. You know your friend and your wife and your brother and your and everybody, and including the taxi driver and the guy in the hamburger joint. All the rest of them, they all have just as much God in them as you do, and they all have this potential. But only you, and this is the big thing, only you are the consciousness point. You're the one that is looking at the world through your eyes. You're the one that's hearing the world through your ears. You're the one that's experiencing, feeling, whatever. The rest of them are, you assume they're doing that, and they are, but you're the one. So therefore, you can't die. You're immortal because you're the consciousness point, and God's got to have consciousness points, and so you're going to go on. So then, the big purpose of magic is let's recover some of these. Let's find out where we've been, and let's find out where we're going. Let's take control of this process. And God will let us do that. God will let us do anything we want because we're part of his creative process. And this is the wonderful thing about magic, is this idea that we're going to become more than just somebody that just gets kicked around by the winds of chance and doesn't know who we are and doesn't know. This is what Hermes means when he says that you have to realize why you're here and what you're here for. And that's what Hermes said. This is why you're here. This is what you're here for. And do it. And do the one. Find the one thing and do it. And Crowley said that. You know, I'm completely a follower. In fact, I'm not a follower of Crowley at all. But I think Crowley said some good things. And one of the things he said was, find your true will and do it. And he was absolutely right about that. And of course, Curly in City Slickers said, find the one thing and do it. And that's another version of it. But anyway, the idea is, you are you. You are very, very special. Even though I'm very special, and the lovely lady I'm sitting next to is also very, very special. But you who are looking out through your eyes and listening through your ears, you are God. And when you realize that, and what will help you realize it, you know, you may not realize it listening to me, you may think I'm a nut, but I tell you, if you study this and work with this long enough, you will realize this. And when you do realize it, it's one of the most precious treasures you can possibly have. This is what we refer to as enlightenment, and it isn't something that should make you feel superior to anybody else. It's just that, hey, I know. I wish the heck they knew. And this is, in a way, this is what Jesus was trying to do. He's trying to tell people pretty much the same thing. And this is why, as I say, we have nothing. We have nothing against Christianity or nothing against Buddhism. It's just that they don't. Some of the not Buddha and Jesus necessarily, but some of the Christians and the Buddhist clergy don't quite tell you. Don't quite tell you all of what maybe they ought to tell you. In the case of Buddha, you know, everything was kind of negative because poor Buddha looked over the wall and he saw how much suffering there was, and so he said, "Oh, this is all illusion." Well, here in the West and with Hermetic philosophy, we look over the wall and we say, "Hey, everything is reality. Especially what you can imagine." Now, magic is the path, the royal art, and the path of those who wish to be more than human. But at the same time, you've got to have sympathy and compassion for the rest of the human race, and you have to be able to identify with them, because they are all in the same situation you're in, even though they don't know it. So consequently, the key to being more than human is being more than one human. And that is something I'll leave you to meditate on. Anyway, we're just about out of time. And so I'm going to just go over here. And I was mentioning this earlier that what we do in what we did in technical writing was we said, okay, we're going to tell you what we're going to tell you, and then we're going to tell you, and then we're going to tell you what we told you. So, in this broadcast, we introduced hermetic science and the history of hermetic science, and we talked about the aspects of astrology and Kabbalah and alchemy that were related to hermetic science and came from it. And we discussed the differences between magic and witchcraft and Satanism, which we have no relationship to. And then we discussed the principles of invocation, that's calling down the angels, and evocation, calling up the spirits using the crystal and the dark mirror. And we described the inner workings of the magical visionary process. And then we summed it up by telling you what we told you. So we'll see you next week, and about the same time, and we'll get a little further into this, and this will conclude our broadcast for tonight.